Welcome to 3GT, the podcast for three guys, a pastor, a professor, and a parishioner discuss theology from a practical standpoint, all from a Reformed perspective. Find out more at 3GT.xyz.
Well, thank you for tuning in to another episode of Three Guys Theologizing, where myself, and I am Kyle Borg, gets the opportunity to sit down with my co-hosts and my friends Scott Hunt and Barry York, a podcast that we hope is somewhat reminiscent of some of the good fellowship and conversations that you might have with good friends around the table after a dinner. That is the goal, the ambition, and the tone of our podcast as we talk about different topics and try to bring a biblical perspective and a Reformed perspective on those things. Well, thanks you guys for joining me today for our most recent conversation. And the topic that we are taking up today is going to be the topic of fasting. Now, just take a little stroll down story time with Kyle for a moment. A couple of months ago, well, probably not even a couple months ago, but I remember I was surfing the internet, and I don't remember where I came across it, but I stumbled upon an article, which was written by a man named David Van Drunen. Now, David Van Drunen is an OPC pastor. He is also a systematic theology professor at Westminster in California, out there in Escondido, our good friends of that seminary. And David Van Drunen had given a sermon, which was turned into an article, which was titled, Should Christians Fast or Feast? And I don't know why I read it, because I don't find David Van Drunen always to be the most engaging author. He's not somebody that I often pick up and read, but I decided to start browsing the article. And I was actually quite surprised at the way in which he began to answer that question, should Christians fast or feast? Let me give you just a brief sampling from this article that has been posted online. Here's what Van Drunen says. Now, you may want to fast as a form of protest because you want the park to be open an hour longer at night, and that's fine. If you want to fast because you think it will help you lose weight, that's fine as well. And then he goes on to say this, but Christians do not ordinarily fast for spiritual reasons, because joy is what stands at the heart of the Christian life. The fruits of the Spirit are not love, grief, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Rather, the fruits of the Spirit are love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Even so, there may be extraordinary times in the life of the church when fasting is appropriate, end quote. So Van Drunen is making the argument, the sustained argument throughout this whole article, that because Christianity, and especially on this side of the cross of Calvary, because of the reality of Christ's accomplished work, we are called to a life of joy and rejoicing, and by and large, notice he said there are extraordinary times where we might be able to fast, but by and large, the Christian life is to be characterized by joy and rejoicing, and he sees that as opposed to fasting. Now, this is the first time I've ever read anything like this, to be honest, that takes this take on fasting. And I thought, well, you know, I don't know that we need to meticulously go through and give a review of the article, but I thought it could be a good launching pad for us to talk a little bit about a biblical view of fasting, and a view that I think will not really agree with what Van Drunen has said. So let me begin simply by, just so we're all on the same page, how would you biblically define fasting? Like, what is it and what is it not? And maybe what's one of the practical reasons it's good to make sure we have a biblical definition in our cultural context?
I would say fasting is simply withholding from yourself food and or other pleasures in order to concentrate on praying to God. I want to make it as simple. It's not a complicated concept, really. It's just the self-denial, so that your focus can be on God. And the idea, I believe, is that every time an urge comes up to eat or whatever other pleasure you might be withholding from yourself, it would be a prompt to just remind you that you're in a time of intense prayer and seeking after God.
And what it is not, Kyle, I know Van Drunen said, you know, if you want to fast to lose weight, that's not fasting. Fasting to lose, that's just being disciplined or, you know, being on a diet. That's not fasting. Fasting, in my opinion, and I think biblically speaking, fasting has in mind two parts. It's one, the setting aside things like food, like Barry has said, but it's not just to set those things aside. It is for the purpose of doing what Barry said, which is for the purpose of intense prayer and focused prayer. So to say you're fasting to lose weight, I think that's just ridiculous, to be honest with you. That's not fasting. That's dieting.
Well, Scott, I think...
Yeah, Kyle.
Well, I take that a little bit personally here. I've been intermittent fasting. You know, I eat for 6-hour window each day and I fast for 18 hours, but...
You're not fasting.
Regardless of how ridiculous you find that, I do agree with you that biblically speaking, fasting has a religious purpose and that it's not just the cessation of food for the sake of losing weight. That's not a spiritual practice.
Well, can I interrupt you for a second? I'm going to anyway. Yeah, you might as well let
me. Talk louder than me. You're such a lawyer. Just talk louder.
So I do think that there are times people fast to lose weight because they are worshiping a god themselves. They've idolized themselves in health and youth. I'm not saying you're doing that, Kyle.
Now I'm taking fasting. A real person, Scott.
Well, there is this idea of the fountain of youth that many people have. And I think that they do not eat for the purpose of glorifying that which is their God to them, an image themselves. So I guess in that respect, if you want to say you're fasting, Kyle, that's on you. I wouldn't call what you're doing fasting.
The cessation of food there. That's what I'm going to start calling it from now on. Well,
thank you.
So I think that's a pretty decent working definition, but Barry, I'm going to offer a little bit of gentle pushback. So we believe in a gentle reformation. We also believe in gentle pushback. I want to just follow through with a thought that you said about fasting from really any kind of pleasure. I remember when I was in high school, one of the cool trends, at least in the evangelical world that I grew up in, was the 30-hour fast. And we were often taught that, you know, biblically speaking, you can fast from anything. You can fast from food. You can fast from video games. You can fast from X, Y, Z, fill in the blank. I'm just wondering, so you said in your definition, if I'm hearing you correctly, that you might agree with that, that fasting doesn't only have to do with food and water or what we eat and drink, but you think it can be any pleasure?
I just meant that it would be withholding food and any other pleasure. If I wasn't precise, I apologize. I do believe that when we look at it biblically, it has to do with food and first and foremost. But I don't think that you can be in the right spirit that fasting would be encouraging biblically if you were not eating, but playing video games and praying. That's just not part and parcel with what it would need to fast.
Okay.
So yeah. I might not have said it
that
precisely, but... Definitely. Yeah. I meant
so you're
fasting
saying,
from food and any other pleasure for a period of time in order to devote yourself to prayer.
So that's helpful because the season of fasting and whatever that is, you know, I think there's a lot of liberty at the length of a fast. You know, I think even biblically speaking, you can see quite a difference there. So to follow on that, then, you know, you say to rest from other pleasures as well while you're not eating the food. Why? What's the purpose of fasting? What is a time of fasting to specifically be marked by?
I think a time of fasting is marked by a time of prayer, an intense focused prayer. I don't think it's just general prayers. You know, I remember back in Kokomo that we had some times of fasting and, you know, the idea was not to just pray about anything. It was seek the Lord's direction or seek the Lord's face on this issue and about this issue. So, you know, when you see Jesus fasting, when you see other people fasting, it was for a reason. You know, to send Paul, you know, to determine who the Lord wanted to send out, you know, Paul and Barnabas. Though there's always I think generally fasting is accompanied by a great beseeching of the Lord for a particular purpose. And it's not necessarily like Van Drunen says, because you're sad or weeping or in grief. I mean, you can do it in Thanksgiving. You're fasting to find out what the Lord wants you to do, or asking the Lord's blessing on a ministry project, or all sorts of things. But I think fasting is defined as for a particular purpose in prayer.
I really agree with Scott that it's a way to focus ourselves in praying. Donald Whitney, in his book, Spiritual Disciplines, talks about how fasting can be a way of overcoming temptation and freshly dedicating ourselves to the Father. Or if we do it with others, it can also be seeking the Father's will. Scott mentioned the church at Antioch in Acts 13. The missionary movement of the early church began as that church was fasting and worshiping God. And it was through that time that the Holy Spirit raised up Paul and Barnabas in their midst to send them out. So there's a real sense of purpose and intensity, I think, when we're talking about fasting. And, you know, contrary to this article that you're mentioning here, Kyle, so first of all, you know, there's so many things that are just going through my mind of, I think, wrong juxtaposition. So even the title says, of fasting or feasting, you know, which are Christians to do. And I would say, well, we're to do both. There's times of fasting and there's times of feasting. But then I might also just turn it around and say that really fasting is a time of feasting on the Lord. John Piper has a book on fasting called Hungering for Christ. And so it's a time where we're to really be feeding our soul spiritually on Jesus. And I find it, rather than being this time of grief and sadness, although there can be periods of fasting for, I would say, difficult times or tragedies that come along and asking God to deliver, a lot of times Christian fasting can be actually quite joyful as we're growing closer to Christ and spending time with Him. So, I really agree with what Scott's saying.
Yeah, I think, trying to spare some of my comments here, but I think that's important to maintain. You know, the Westminster Directory for Public Worship, and public is spelled with a K, not in a pretentious way. That's the way they used to do it. But the Westminster Directory for Public Worship, I think, gives us a pretty good definition when it says, you know, when some great and notable judgment is inflicted upon a people or apparently imminent, or by some extraordinary provocations notoriously deserved, a people are to fast. But it also adds that when we are seeking some special blessing to be obtained. And I think, you know, there does seem, at least in my mind, when I think about fasting kind of off the top of my head, there does seem in the Bible to be a bit more of an emphasis on kind of the grief and the sorrow and the mourning part of God having brought a judgment. You know, that's why Jesus teaches that, you know, when you fast, you know, don't wear this dour, sour expression on your face like the Pharisees do. But I think Scott is right to point out, as he did earlier, that, you know, fasting was a part of sending Paul and Barnabas off and sending them along their way, seeking a special blessing to be obtained through their ministry, so that you can't think on that occasion and just think, well, they were all dour and sour and, oh, you know, like they were expectant and hopeful about what the gospel was about to accomplish through their ministry. So I think that's important. What you guys are saying here is we can't be so narrow and just say, well, the biblical emphasis does seem to be mourning and grief, therefore that's what it can only mean. It's not what it can mean. But I do think it's an important part. So let's look at that aspect just a little bit before we come to the joyful, maybe rejoicing side of things. You know, why fast as an expression of grief and mourning? You guys have kind of hinted at this, but let's elaborate a little more and be very clear and specific. You know, what are some biblical examples of people fasting kind of in dire straits?
I think we see in the book of Jonah that when Jonah eventually makes it to Nineveh and preaches there the judgment of God upon the city, that the king calls for the people to clothe themselves in sackcloth and ashes and to fast and pray. And so in times of judgment, I think that's a certainly an important time that we would do that. And I think it's to demonstrate to the Lord that we've been cut to the heart with what he's doing. And we recognize that unless he were to deliver us, there would be no deliverance. And so I think it's very important for us to realize that fasting really just shows that I want my, there's a lot of times in the Bible where it talks about, you know, I'll give my whole heart to the Lord. And I think fasting really helps you to do that. You're cutting yourself off from all your earthly attachments and even the food that sustains you, and you're giving yourself to the Lord. Another occasion would be when the son of David with Bathsheba grew ill as an infant, and he spent a week fasting for that child to be delivered. And that shows, again, a great time of grave concern over a situation. And David realizing not only was this child ill, but this son had come into the world because of his immoral behaviors. And I think it just was all culminating in his heart and mind at a time where he was just emptying himself before the Lord. And of course, on that occasion, God didn't answer the way that David wanted. He wanted the life of the child to be spared. And to that prayer, God said no. And yet David still, I think, because of being in that state of proper mind and prayer, I think was able to respond appropriately to that situation then, where he expressed his faith that though the child would not come to him, that one day he would see that child in heaven.
And, you know, I think of, which may be more relevant to us, but, you know, Nehemiah saw the temple broken down and heard mm-hmm. about this. And when he stopped and fasted. And I think, you know, he was really mourning and lamenting the judgment of the Lord, right? Like Barry has talked about. But we see that today. We see churches falling away from the faithful proclamation of the gospel. We see Christians walking away, and it should cause us to mourn and be at grief when God brings judgment upon the church. I mean, I think that's not a time for celebration. I mean, that's the King Jesus doing what purifying his church. I think that should cause us to be in grief and be fasting and prayer and confession, which I think are all very biblical responses to those situations that we see examples of in the Old Testament for sure.
Yeah. What I think is helpful in the examples that you guys have brought up is, you know, it's interesting in Scott's case with Nehemiah, it's the church that is fasting. What's always interesting to me is in Jonah, it's this pagan nation. It is a nation by the edict of a king that all of you need to wear sackcloth and ashes, and we are going to corporately go about fasting. You know, we think in terms of maybe our context, you know, Thanksgiving is always by the proclamation of a president. Even in our country, every time Thanksgiving comes around, it is a proclamation of feasting, being thankful for the blessings. And you know, we won't trace out the truth of all of that and the hypocrisy that often accompanies a presidential proclamation. But we see a biblical pattern that would be appropriate too for our governing officials to tell our nation it is now a time of fasting, because the judgment of God is against us. And so we do see this biblical emphasis that fasting is appropriate both for the church and for the nations, even though that is not, you would never expect to see that in our own context. Well, let's get to, so part of David Van Drunen's point, or were you going to say something, Barry?
Oh, I was just going to respond real quickly that when 9/11 struck, and you think that we're now at the 20th anniversary of that this year, that instead of really calling for fasting, we had this national prayer service that was anything but the appropriate response. It had all these different religions mixed up in it and just blasphemous things that were said there at the National Cathedral. And so it's just the opposite, really, response to what you see biblically when an individual like David or a whole nation like Nineveh responds appropriately before God in light of one of his judgments.
you know, you bring up the example of 9/11, but wow, how much more so in what we've experienced in this last year. And without politicizing, you know, without politicizing the reality of COVID and what it was, you know, you could think very easily that last March, when all of us were standing on the precipice of uncertainty, you know, is this thing going to wipe out millions of people? How we, you know, and I know that our church did fast. There were days of fasting called by presbyteries to pray that the Lord would spare and remove his hand. And part of me has wondered if we ever just thought that, you know, the numbers are not nearly as bad as some of the models. Maybe the Lord did work through the prayers of his people. But what a time for our nation and for the nations of this world to humbly prostrate themselves before God. You know, a virus brought everything in this world to a standstill. I mean, you would think that would wake us up to the reality and our own humility. Well, so one of the points that Van Drunen makes is that he thinks, by and large, it's inappropriate for Christians to fast as New Testament Christians, if I can put it that way, on this side of Calvary. How would you guys go about just demonstrating, you know, very clearly that fasting is to have a place in our personal and in our corporate lives?
Some of the listeners might be wondering how he could arrive at that position, because when you were telling me about the argument, I was going, what? Like, how could he get there? And so Kyle, you might help us just to help the listeners a little bit understand, what is it in his theology or his exegesis that's driving him to this? I have the sense that knowing some of his theological perspective with respect to the two kingdom, he's probably viewing this as more of an Old Testament type law that's no longer necessary in this period of the New Testament age and the age of the Spirit. Is that how he's going about it, or is it?
Yeah. And so he would take, right, in having read it, and I hope I'm fairly representing the article, I too, Barry, was shocked when I read this. And I was like, I can't quite wrap my mind around this. This is strange to me. But really, the epicenter of his point comes from Matthew chapter 9, verses 14 through 17, where Jesus, the disciples of John, come to Jesus and say, why do we and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not? And Jesus goes on to give that teaching that, you know, when the bridegroom is present, you don't fast. That's the time for feasting. And Jesus, of course, saying, I am the bridegroom. Why would my disciples fast when I am present, when I am here? And not to just regurgitate the entire article, but that becomes then the epicenter or the springboard for Van Drunen to go on and say, you know, Jesus is still present. The church is the bride of Christ. He is present with us. And kind of taking that, then he's kind of trying to prove his point that we don't need to fast. That was true prior to the coming of Christ. It was an Old Testament thing, and we're no longer under that. Hmm.
Yeah, I just don't see that interpretation of that passage, because in chapter 9, verse 15, he says, can the wedding guests mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? But he was there with them presently. That's why his disciples immediately weren't fasting. But then he does go on to say, the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them and they will fast. And I guess his interpretation of that sentence would be that they would fast during the 3 days that he was in the grave. And then afterward, there would be no time for fasting because now the bridegroom's with us. Whereas I think most of us would, well, most of us, at least I think I would read that to mean that he's in heaven and we're waiting for him to come back and consummate his marriage to his bride. And during these days, the church will fast. Now, it will be a fasting, I would agree, of a different quality perhaps than in the Old Testament, because they didn't have the greater knowledge of Christ. They were only looking ahead to their Christ coming. And so they didn't understand all that meant for them, the saints of old. So definitely we can fast with a greater hope and a greater understanding than Old Testament saints. But I do not believe that this passage is teaching that we would not fast at all.
We have the example in the New Testament.
Yes.
After Jesus has risen from the dead and ascended to the right hand of the Father, where the church is fasting on more than one occasion. And so, I think that shows us that there is still a place for fasting in the church.
Yeah, I think too, you know, he really, if we try to be as charitable as we possibly can, you know, his heart in conveying this message is that the Christian life is to be characterized primarily by joy and rejoicing. And I think we would all say, well, yeah, that's true, you know, and maybe not in the John Piper sense of joy and Christian hedonism, but we would certainly see that joy has a very important place in the Christian life. At the same time, it seems to me that you have to balance that with the place of present mourning. You know, how many of the Psalms would become completely irrelevant for New Covenant Christians if there was no room for grief and sorrow and mourning in the Christian life, right? And this is the songbook that God has given us, you know, regardless of what your views are on whether or not you should sing exclusively or not, we should all be agreed. Well, yeah, the Psalms have a place, a continued place in the church. And how many people testify to the fact that in their darkest, most sorrowful days, it's the Psalms that gave vent to these things, you know, so that we can't let joy and rejoicing, as pivotal as it is, eclipse that. But I also think personally, you know, he runs the risk of, I think, very superficially defining joy and rejoicing as if joy and rejoicing are polar opposite or absolutely contrary to a godly grief and sorrow. You guys have thoughts on that? On anything I just was babbling about?
Well, I think you said joy and rejoicing. You meant joy and rejoicing and fasting. Is that...
I meant joy and I think he sees joy and rejoicing as the opposite end of the spectrum from grief. And I don't know that I would make that so polarized in a biblical. I don't think the Bible would actually encourage us to polarize those.
I would agree. I mean, there is a time for joy, unless you take out, you know, all the Old Testament. I mean, there is a time for joy and a time for grief. That's what the wise preacher said in Ecclesiastes, but they're not, like you said, Kyle, I don't think they're on this. We have to separate them. They're not North and South Pole that will never touch. I mean, there are times when your joy and your grief are mixed together. And I think that's particularly seen at a funeral of a believer. I mean, there is grief and there's profound grief. If, you know, By the grace of God, I've never had to go through it, but you know, you lose a parent, you lose a sibling, you lose a child. There's great grief there. And yet at the same time for the Christian, there is great joy. And so I think to put those on opposite ends of the spectrum is just not to do justice to the Christian faith.
Yeah. So that takes me back. You mentioned Piper, and I do think a good book on this, and I think I misquoted earlier, I said a hunger for Christ. It's actually a hunger for God. And in his book, Piper's really trying to reestablish that, particularly here in the West, the Christian church doesn't fast. It's just not a regular practice among many. You go to other parts of the world where I know my brothers in Asia, for instance, fasting is just more of a regular part of their experience as Christians there, partly because they're under persecution and they're asking God to deliver them. They're asking God to help them as they expand. They see the church expanding at a rate where they can't even train up enough leaders to take care of it. So there's many reasons for them to feel a sense of a dependency on God that perhaps we don't, because we're so comfortable here in the West. But one of the things that Piper, in trying to encourage the church, of course, around the world, but particularly I think he's speaking to American Christianity, is that this is one of the disciplines, this is one of the means of grace that God has given to us to seek him. And as Scott has said, it doesn't have to be always just because we're grieving over something. It could be done in a joyful way. And one of the things that, one of the passages that this book's primarily based upon is on the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 6, where Jesus in Matthew 6, verses 6 through 18, I think you referenced it just a little earlier, Kyle, was talking about that when we fast, we shouldn't look gloomy and downcast and draw attention to our fasting, but we should, you know, take our showers and use our shampoo if we need to, you know, those kinds of things. And and not let everyone in, quote, in on the secret, that there's a lot of individual fasting that's done where we don't draw any attention to it. We don't even let people know that we're doing it. And the reason is, and I love Piper on this, he says, when you fast, and this would pertain to prayer as well, because he says this, the Lord says the same thing about praying earlier in this passage. When you fast and pray, you will get the attention of the one that you're seeking. So if you fast and you're doing it in order to be seen by men, so that they'll say, oh yeah, look how spiritual that guy is because he's fasting, then you got what you were seeking. You wanted human approval, you got it. But if you fast in secret and you're really only seeking God and seeking his attention, then as Jesus says, the Father who sees you in secret will reward you. And I think that's so important to this whole subject, that we're doing it in an earnest, sincere desire that God would see my prayer and answer what I'm asking for. And that is joy. Like Jesus teaches us that when he answers prayer, that's when our joy can be most full. And it is such a joy to see God, the God of heaven, the God who made us, the God who redeemed us, that we're in this living, dynamic, experiential relationship with him. And that when I seek him, he does answer me. And it's a beautiful thing. And so I think that's why we can't say that fasting is only to be associated with grieving. Yeah, I might be grieving over not getting more of my wife's cooking, but I'm getting something, dare I say, even better.
Dare you say. Well, I think that actually, we are running out of time, and that's a good point to end on. And so, of course, there's all kinds of things that we could talk about in relation to fasting, the practice of it and things like that. But I think this was a helpful episode. So thank you guys for this discussion. I want to thank our listeners for continuing with us week by week as we sit around the table and we theologize on all kinds of topics. But be sure to head over to our website 3gt.xyz for more information and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, because guess what, you never actually want to miss an episode of 3GT, and subscribing is the best way to make sure you get it delivered to you right away. Well, we thank you for tuning in. Until next time, see ya.